This is KXLU 88.9 FM and LA KXLU.com all around the world. We are broadcasting from the Loyola Marymount University campus. The sun has just set. The Salsa Fest has just finished. I am Mystic Pete, your host for a show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. Thank you, Ernesto, for another beautiful show. We've been partying here on the campus all day, but now it's time to get serious and do some real good talk radio. And I have an extraordinary guest in studio today. Christine will be here in a little while, too. Jake Broder is here. Hi, Jake.
Hi. How are you?
Oh, that's a nice radio voice. Hi, Jake. Well, let me have you introduce yourself. You're up to some really great work and have a wonderful project coming up very soon. But go ahead and explain what's happening.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Currently, we are about to open and have the world premiere of Unraveled, which is a play and a whole brain health festival happening at the Wallace in Beverly Hills on October 17th, 18th, and 19th. And this is the world premiere of a work that a lot of us have now been working on since 2017. So we're really excited to bring you this story.
You created and wrote this show. It's going to be performed at the Wallace. A lot of people don't know about the Wallace, but it's a rather new venue in the place where the Beverly Hills post office was. Just a beautiful venue. And it's a theater piece. It's a play with music. And we'll watch you explain what this play is all about.
It is a beautiful venue. And the building itself is really cool because it used to be the Beverly Hills post office. And it has this amazing marble foyer and all these kind of amazing spaces, a whole campus. And we'll be using a lot of that whole campus for the Brain Health Festival, but inside this gorgeous 500-seat theater with the just exquisite acoustics and sort of wooden inside and great baffling. The sound is just glorious. And the stage itself is much bigger than what a 500-seat theater should be. So it's a really beautiful room. This play has five actors and five musicians, and it's being directed by James Bonus, who is this extraordinary director of opera and ballet and theater from the UK, who I'm so lucky and happy to be working with. It is a play that is about a woman named Anne Adams, who was 53, and she wasn't a very good painter. She was a scientist. And then all of a sudden, she became obsessed with Ravel's Bolero. And she painted it, and she became this kind of extraordinary painter all of a sudden. Why? How? And her relationship with her husband really started to change. Her behavior started to change. And it turns out that she got a diagnosis of primary progressive aphasia, losing words, which became frontotemporal dementia. But she continued to paint, and her art not only took a big sort of quantum leap upwards at the age of 53, but then it continued to develop as her language abilities began to deteriorate. And the kicker is that Ravel, 70 years earlier, composed Bolero at the same point in his life, and he had the same condition. He had FTD as well. And Bolero and the painting, 70 years apart, are both creative outputs made by people at the exact same point with the exact same disease. There's something sort of beautiful and chilling and important about the fact that those two things rhyme. So this is a story about that includes a lot of music
By the way, right after my theme song, that's some of the music from the play that I just played a minute ago.
Yeah, that is Mark Gray, who is an exquisite composer, has taken Bolero and is almost deconstructing it down to its bones and is using it throughout the piece. And then at the end, we give you a big full Bolero with a twist. But also the paintings and the animation that's happening. Adam Larson, this extraordinary video designer, is using the paintings as a template to create all kinds of visuals and try to help the audience feel what it would be like to be inside Anne's head. And so these visuals are happening that then result and resolve into the paintings and then dissipate and then come back. And so this is a play, but it's also a visual experience and it's also an auditory experience, and all these things sort of coming together, really synthesized into trying to share this story with you.
Okay, so to recap, there's the Unraveled Brain Health Festival, which is to raise awareness for FTD, frontotemporal dementia. And your play called Unraveled is going to be a part of that, performed at the Wallace in Beverly Hills on October 17th, 18th, and 19th. Okay, so that's where we are right now.
Right.
People have heard about dementia. People have heard about Alzheimer's, brain tumors, glial cell tumor. There's a lot about the brain that can go wrong. There can be a lot of problems. Let's start with the science part and explain what is going on here and how FTD is distinguished from Alzheimer's, for instance, and other brain conditions.
Okay, that's a great question, because dementia is an umbrella term, and it means a lot of different things to different people. We're living in a really interesting and beautiful time, because we're outliving our brains for the first time in human history, which means that we have a responsibility right now to develop a language to talk about these things. Dementia is not just Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's, forgetting. People associate dementia with purely Alzheimer's, that it's just, oh, somebody's forgetting something, or they've lost their short-term memory, or, you know, memory developments is Alzheimer's, and that's a very specific kind of dementia. And yes, it is common. But frontotemporal dementia, which is a different kind, which means that there are different parts of the brain that are being affected, is the most common form of dementia for people under 60 in this country. And yet, we don't really talk about it, and we don't really know about it. Bruce Willis was recently diagnosed with FTD.
So the actor Bruce Willis, and this has been in the paper, and questions about whether he's being exploited or whatever. So there's been a lot of reporting about this, but go ahead. He's a famous actor, for people who don't know the name.
He has FTD, and his wife, Emma, who has become a huge advocate for FTD and for caregivers, and has really devoted her life to both taking care of him and helping the world understand a little bit more about what this is. It's heroic work to take that kind of pain and translate it into helping in real time. He had it for a while, and they came out, I think, with a diagnosis of aphasia, losing words. And that's when all those stories, you know, in the time before the diagnosis, that's when all the stories came out.
By the way, I just want to add, so people understand, they were having him do scenes on movies, and he was having an extremely difficult time even remembering one line. And, you know, people were complaining, oh, you're taking advantage of this poor man. But look, if the guy can make money, however he's doing it, this is a very expensive disease. You know, let him work as much as he can while he still can. Anyway, but go ahead.
And so they took he had this diagnosis, and the way it's been publicized, it's changed a little bit the way people talk about it, because it's not this faraway thing. You can say, oh, FTD, the kind that Bruce Willis has, and people go, oh, okay. It gives us an anchor. It gives you an anchor point to sort of begin the discussion. Because to answer your previous question, the difference between Alzheimer's and FTD is that Alzheimer's is about memory and FTD is about behavior. You don't lose your memory when you have FTD. There's different kinds of FTD, but there's the non-fluent variant where you lose words, aphasia. There's the behavioral variant where you lose empathy for others. It becomes a disorder of social cognition. And so the behaviors that people exhibit aren't forgetting. They're interpersonal active things that might seem like something else. So that's how it's different.
And if they lose their social skills, you know, they may be impolite or difficult to be with, or, I mean, you know, it's a problem socially, but if it's a mental condition, you know, we have to have understanding for it and treatments, and it's demanding on a partner, and it's difficult to care for.
It's hugely demanding on the partner, and also it comes with a sense of, this is a tough word, but a friend of mine is writing a book about it now, and I still don't think I can pronounce it. Anosognosia, which means...
Well done. Never heard it before.
It means you don't know that you have it.
You don't know you have it. Yeah, right.
Basically.
Like stupid people don't know they're stupid.
Yes.
Okay.
And so you have somebody with FTD walking around like they're in the eye of a hurricane. And the people who are in the force part of it are the people who love them. Because the somebody who is, you know, all of a sudden is behaving with much more impulsivity or with a lack of empathy or is becoming addiction prone or, you know, all the behavioral variant kind of symptoms, you could think, wow, this person is just really being a jerk, or this is really cruel, this is mean, what's wrong with you? And it's not a psychiatric problem. It's not a problem that is based on how a person feels about you. They are literally, that part of their brain that does empathy is broken.
It's a physiological issue. A part of the brain is not functioning right.
Correct.
And not to get too deep into the science here, but from my limited understanding, Alzheimer's is kind of related to plaque accumulating in the brain. What would be the cause of FTD? The short answer, if we know.
Well, back in 1906, Alois Alzheimer identified plaques and tangles. And plaques are the, you know, the things that cause the, that get onto the blood vessel, stop the blood vessels from working and get onto the neurons and stop it working.
Instead of on your teeth, it's inside your brain.
Exactly. Whereas with the tangles are... tau. That's the part that actually starts to degenerate the neurons themselves. And so those are different causes of neurodegeneration. FTD has different mechanisms than Alzheimer's in terms of how it manifests and why it happens. There's genetic forms, and then there's sporadic forms. But people need to study the genetic forms in order to find a pathway to a cure that then is taken out to the sporadic forms as well.
You think you're saying a lot of words to basically mean we don't know. We don't know enough.
We absolutely don't know enough, but we know more than we did. And as a non-scientist, I'm looking at this field and I feel incredibly hopeful that in 10 years or so that we're going to be thinking about this and talking about this very differently than we are now. I think we're on the verge of a pink ribbon moment. And the part of why I'm doing this is because I think we're about to hit a seismic societal change the way we did with cancer in when the pink ribbon happened. I think we're about to hit that with dementia. I want to help accelerate that along. I think it's we're here.
I just want to make a couple quick points that dementia is such. My parents both had dementia, but they're in their 90s, and it was like, yeah, that's kind of what you do in your mid 90s is you kind of forget everything. But it's such a complicated and difficult disease at some point that it really has to be solved by society. Like if it's all on the spouse to deal with this, you're going to have two people go down. It's just wait. You need institutions and a strong caregiving system to really support this incredibly difficult, multifaceted disability. And we are not there as a society. Maybe if you're rich, but for the rest of us, it has to be a community effort to help people who are going through this situation that a lot of people are experiencing. So I'm just to bring it into the big picture.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. Did you have a...
Absolutely. I think the mechanism through which that happens in community is empathy. I think cultivating empathy about this condition, about these conditions, and about people who have them and those who love them is, and that's not like a faraway economic-based thing. That's something that we can do. That's part of the function of, you know, what storytelling can do. We absolutely need to achieve what you just said 100%. And the way to do that, I think, is to cultivate empathy in others, which gets the ball rolling.
Fair enough. I'm going to play another cue from the play and just give us a little moment, and then we will be back and continue the discussion. Christine just showed up. Hey, Christine, you're going to be helping out with some questions. You've actually worked with some dementia patients. We'll get into personal experiences in a while. Why don't you just say hi?
Hello. What a beautiful, lovely night.
Isn't Jake incredible? Wow, this is the kind of radio I love to do that really give people information that affects their lives, but also related to the arts. My whole life is about spirituality and information and science and the arts. Yes, we are talking about dementia and this play that Jake has created. It's playing at the Wallace October 17th, 18th, and 19th. And by the way, what's the best website for people to find out more information about it?
Unraveledplay.com. That's with two L's, unraveledplay.com.
Unraveled. And you can also go to the Wallace website. I'm sure it's up there, but yeah. Okay. And so you're the writer, yeah. And that music was by Mark Gray, right? That we just played.
Yeah, the amazing Mark Gray.
Okay. We'll play some more music. Now, let's bring in a bit of a controversial issue. I know some of the people helping this production are big corporations, big pharmaceutical corporations. And they're getting a lot of heat these days, and there's a lot of anger about big pharma and so forth. But okay, there are problems. But I would like to point out that big pharma is also doing some miraculous things. So do you want to talk a little about that, Cross, about like they're coming up with medicine that's going to solve this. Nobody else is going to, right?
Well, there's an amazing pipeline that exists between people who have ideas and how they get tested and then how they get brought to market. And where the public and where the government and where universities all feed into this pipeline that then becomes part of the commercialization of those outputs, it's a tremendously huge endeavor. The first pill costs $2 billion to make. The second one costs, you know, a hell of a lot less.
Right.
Where does that
is an enormous investment to create new powerful medicine.
Huge. And it comes from where does that come from? Who pays for it? Who develops it?
You need massive corporations that have a lot of money that can back this kind of science. And yes, hopefully they're doing it because they will make money at some point curing all the people with dementia.
Well, there is a tremendous need, and so there is a tremendous incentive to solve this. And, you know, if you look at what's happening with the NIH and everything that's going on with universities having their research cut. It's been extraordinary. I'm an artist and I'm working sort of on the periphery of this, but even I've seen things get much harder to move forward because all of the funding cuts that have happened, and then other people have to step in to keep critical research going, you know, not plays, but like actual save lives stuff. And then we're sort of at the end of this food chain and we're suffering, but it's just the knock-on effects have been extraordinary. But then you realize that actually contextualizing this struggle, contextualizing brain health and what that means for a lay audience, for people, and look, I mean, I make jokes about this, but like the only people who need to care about this issue are people who have brains or who love somebody who has one.
Yeah.
Those are the only two kinds of people who need to deal with this.
I love brains.
But not in like a zombie way. But the
good one.
Oh, no.
Is there some humor in the play?
Yeah.
Okay.
Got
some jokes in there. Okay.
Oh God, yes. I like the idea of like people have such a good time they don't realize what a bad time they're having. That I feel like it's important. Like the last thing I want people to come, I don't want people to feel that dreary weight of oh no.
It's like an ordeal, an evening where that's grim and
yeah, no.
No, this is fun.
Absolutely. Got absolutely. It. Absolutely. And I think fun can be wonder, fun can be joy, fun can be delicate exploration of something terrifically complicated but with empathy. Like those things are not a heavy lift for your heart to go to that place. I don't want to have people come in with a heavy and be wrecked. We're trying to open up and lift. And that means we're not sitting around moping or trying to... I mean, a lot of art about dementia is pain porn. And it's really good for statues and it's really good for awards. And it's like, look how I suffer so beautifully. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have any redemption or any sort of thing sometimes past the, oh, look at the delicacy with which I can track how this falling apart occurs. Exactly. And it doesn't have enough of a function. So I think we're trying to reframe the discussion a little bit when we're talking about brains and be able to say, look, there are things that happen that are really hard and really difficult, and they are, and that's just true. But there is also real beauty and capability and resilience and extraordinary creative outputs that are evidenced and true. I didn't make it up. It's there. And if it's true for these two amazing people, Ann Adams and Revell, then, oh my God, what is true for your everyday person? That'll be true a little bit too. So there has to be storytelling which sort of balances the scales a bit, because you're not going to win everybody. You're not going to win anybody by just, you know, anatomizing heartbreak. We all feel that. We all know it already.
Right. It's beautiful what you just said. And I think the best artists can handle. Yeah, it's beautiful. The best artists can take very serious topics and make it accessible and even fun. Or we have Halloween coming up, and there's all kinds of fun and celebration around death and ghosts and ghouls and vampires. Anyway, just to finish kind of the point I was getting to a minute ago, and then we're going to move on to a little bit more of the details of the art. You know, I never thought I would be like a cheerleader for big pharma, but if there's going to be a cure for Alzheimer's, if there's going to be a cure for FTD, it's going to come through a medicine. This is like something, you know, they inject or you take a pill. This is how it's going to solve, and we need to put a lot of money into it, and then this won't be some specter haunting civilization anymore. You know, at some point, healthcare will be a little bit more advanced and wise, and there will be bigger systems. What we got right now is big pharmaceuticals doing it, so do it. I don't think celery juice and coffee enemas are going to solve FTD. So, you know.
Unfortunately not. Would it were so. I think helping people understand that when behavior changes in a person, the brain has changed. That there is a neurological basis for behavior. That that doesn't sort of exonerate people from making choices, but it allows all of us to have a little bit more empathy for why people do what they do, especially in the context of a neurodegenerative disease or a kind of dementia, because it stops the blame. It stops the, why are you choosing to do this? Why did you forget? Why are you acting like this?
Yeah, you get mad at them. We lose patience with these people.
If you saw somebody whose finger was cut off and you're like, why can't you play that note? You'd be like, why are you being so mean? Yeah. Why are you, they're not capable of playing the note. They don't have a finger. So it's sort of the same kind of thing.
No, I think it's a cycle of healing.
Do you have a tell me about a situation when you're working with someone with dementia? Just a
mostly they are more like going back and trying to remember, and I think that is like they need to get over it with some treatment. Alternatives to heal themselves.
It's interesting because treatment and caregiving are really, really related.
Mm-hmm.
When you have somebody who has memory issues or isn't able to access certain kinds of episodic memory, there are other ways. There's so many great sort of non-pharmacological artistic interventions developed to help people access memories, be more comfortable, try to avoid like sundowning, that period between, you know, 4 and 7 o'clock when people often with these conditions really get quite agitated. And there are all kinds of art therapies that can really help people. Music, visual art, storytelling, movement, that can contribute either to cognitive development and build resilience, or emotional, or frankly, one of the biggest things that people with this experience is isolation. So developing social connections in their community, with their family,
very important.
Super important.
Oh my God,
people
yes.
get isolated and yes. it gets worse. Cause,
yes.
Correct.
They go.
Because it's hard to find somebody to talk. You know,
and just the patience required.
Yes.
And that's something you were good at.
Yes.
Well, this is a good segue. So let's talk about Bolero, and let's talk about Dr. Anne Adams and Maurice Ravel. And this was, go ahead.
Anne Adams? Well, Anne Adams was a 53-year-old Canadian scientist who was always interested in painting, but then all of a sudden she had this artistic blossom at the age of 53, and it was really sudden. It wasn't like, oh, I've developed into. It was like, chunk, really happened quickly. And she was obsessed with Ravel's Bolero, which is an extraordinary piece of music and is not typical of what Ravel wrote in the rest of his
His other pieces sound nothing like Bolero, and Bolero sounds nothing like any other classical piece. I'm very familiar with all classical. I've done a lot of shows.
Yeah.
Bolero is unique.
It really is, and it's extraordinary. And it is one of the most frequently played pieces of classical music now by orchestras all over the world. I don't know if it's number one, but it must be quite close. I think it might be. I don't know. But you've seen it. It keeps popping up in these sort of cultural iconic moments. You know, Torvald and Dean at the Olympics won with it in 1984. Everybody of a certain age remembers 10 with Bo Derek running down the beach. You know, Kurosawa put it in the film. There's all kinds of, it keeps coming back and keeps coming back. So it's sort of, why is this such a huge piece of music? And what's interesting about it is that Ravel and Anne had the same disease, and she started painting Bolero, and Ravel composed Bolero at the same point in the progression of their disease, the beginning.
Wow. That's a sign.
It is. Very much. It's a sign that this painting and this music rhyme across time. It's a sign that those two creative outputs, which are features of FTD, not a bug. They were created because of this condition, not in spite of it. And it's a sign that human beings are capable of extraordinary things, even with a neurodegenerative condition.
Oh, that's so beautiful.
And
everything is possible.
Yeah.
Everything is possible.
Yeah. It's evidence, it's proof that the mind is more plastic than we ever thought possible.
Well, it's kind of a remarkable thing that happened. And we were talking earlier about some kind of patterning that happens, some repetition with the brain, and Bolero is like the same phrase repeated over and over and over. And
yep.
You would think this is a boring music, but it's compelling. And it's also to me reminiscent of, well, I work with electronic music a lot and meditation music, and even hearkening back to medieval music like Gregorian chants, Hildegard von Bingham. In other words, there's something about repeating music that can be very compelling, and something about, Ravel got it with Bolero. I don't know how he figured out, but he did.
He got it, or it got him, but it came in and it was repetitive. I mean, there is something kind of universal about the idea of music that repeats with like a small variation, and repeats and repeats, repeats, but with like a small variation. That kind of information is the same patterning of what genetics are. Genes are really simple things over and over and over and over in the same exact pattern with one small variation. Rinse and repeat, ad infinitum, until you become very far away from where you started. There's something kind of beautiful, divine, sort of Jungian greatness about what Bolero is, because some people are hugely irritated by it. Other people are... they find it the most sort of erotic thing they've ever listened to. Other people listen to it and think, this is sort of magnificent in the way people... I mean, I've seen people at the orchestra, you sit there and you watch and you go, ooh, it's over there. Ooh, it's over there. Ooh, it's over there. Ooh, it's over there. And then it hits the climax, whoosh! I mean, it just... the audience rises up and howls with delight every time. He designed that.
And somehow influenced or created by this disease. It's nothing like the other music he's played. So I think we should play some of it now. People may recognize it. I'm not going to play all 13 minutes of it, although once you start listening, you want to hear it to the end. But we'll get through a little bit of it so people have some reference. And we'll be right back. KXLU. Thank you. Well, I'm going to keep this playing in the background, something you shouldn't do with classical music. But there's definitely, I just noticed for the first time, there's something very kind of Middle Eastern in the melodies going on. He was an impressionist musician. And this, I don't know, this doesn't really sound impressionist or anything else. It's just its own thing.
No, those Middle Eastern tones that you're talking about, he was Basque. It's that sort of.
Oh, he was Basque.
Yeah. And his mom was. And so. Yeah, he comes from that. If you listen to a lot of his music, has that sort of almost Moorish Spanish sort of those tones.
I'm learning about Ravel.
Yeah, he has a lot of that style that he leans into.
Well, how'd that make you feel?
I got a little chill. It was so powerful.
There we go.
Powerful.
As I was listening to it, I was thinking about we have a 3D printer at home whose name is Jeremy. And
it has a name, okay.
Yeah, Louis named it. And sometimes I think I'm listening to it because Tiggs likes to print things late into the night. And I'm listening to it and it kind of sounds like the repetitive stuff because it zips around and does all these things. So it has the same exact pattern sound, but then it gets shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. So it gets like quicker and quicker and quicker. But it's the same sort of the math of the noise. There's so much sort of beautiful math in Bolero, which is just so apparent.
We're just going to a whole new level. Okay, good.
How has the FTD community responded to the play?
Well, I have to, in humility, say that I have been astounded, delighted, and honored to be able to support this community and the way that they have rallied around this. And they're in the process of forming right now. And there are some incredible lights in this field who have been doing it for a while, and it's just beautiful. You know, the Association for Frontotemporal Dementia, the AFTD, all the people at the GBHI, the Global Brain Health Institute, Lilly, the Dana Foundation, the Kissick Family Foundation, Emma, who's Bruce's wife, has been an extraordinary supporter of this. And we're gathering all of those people together to come at the show to do these talkbacks to ask some of the tough questions I think you were leaning into. We're going to sit down with a panel of those people and say, okay, what's next? What's the hardest bit? What do you need help with? What happens now? And having an interdisciplinary panel of artists and pharma and funders and scientists and doctors and caregivers and people with lived experience all talking about this issue together, I think it's the way we move, and advocates and advocacy, that's the way we move things forward. You have to have sort of all the constituents, all the stakeholders around the table to be able to create A, momentum, and B, progress.
So there is a community right now that's really tackling this. I mean, you know, there's the breast cancer community and AIDS community, but this is on people's minds more, pun intended.
Yeah, it's definitely on people's minds more. And, you know, part of that is because there is a moment, because there's treatments that are coming down the pike, because there are going to be therapeutics coming, because there's enough advancements. There's our view of what treatment means is changing and is becoming more empathetic and more helpful. And also there is a recognition of this condition happening, and somebody who is a beloved person in the entertainment community who, I mean, Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS has a lot of funding and has for
a long
time.
There's a community there, right, exactly.
And part of that was because it was called Lou Gehrig's disease from the very beginning. And
he was a famous baseball player.
Yeah, and there was love there. And so people were like, oh, okay. And so this is sort of, there's a Bruce Willis effect, which I think is that it's going to allow a lot of people to say, okay, it's all right to care about this. It's all right to recognize that it's happening. And it's not that he's the only person, but
I think that's the beauty, to accept it.
Yeah.
So everybody will be open.
That's the hope.
So there's the discussion. The awareness is raised. Otherwise, nobody's interested. There's no funding. And now, through the arts, you're doing your part. So let's talk about how this play came together. What's the personal connection? And how did this get written? And
well,
confide in us. Just between us.
Just between us. Just between us girls. Radio. It's because of radio. I was sitting in my car listening to Radiolab in 2017. And at the time, I was scared out of my mind because my dad had something, but we didn't know what it was. And we knew something was coming. And I was just terrified. So this was very much on my mind. So I listened to this program about Ann Adams and Revell and hear about how they both had this condition and how it had this creative burst before it took a lot of things away. And I was like, oh my God. Dementia is not just disintegrating and disappearing and being destroyed. It's a dynamic process which has hope as well as despair. It has creative outputs and tough things. It's both. And so I looked at the painting and I listened to Bolero together and my mind was blown because I felt like I heard how those two things, I heard what you called, I heard you said you called it a sign. I felt like I could feel that. And it felt like hope to me. And that hope for that little bit of time was stronger than the fear I felt about my own father, who I love very much. But even though, so that's like, Nixon goes to China. If I could feel hope in that situation, then I thought that was the aha moment I had, which was like, wow, okay, this story has hope inside it. I'm living proof of that because I'm very upset about this thing. If I can feel that, then I am duty bound as an artist to do what I do, which is project the things that I freak out about onto other people. And
you're a playwright and an actor. That's
what I do.
Yeah. Okay.
So I have to do this. So that's where it hit me. And I've been chasing that dragon, wanting to share that moment of hope and wonder and sort of magic. And it's not Pollyanna nothingness. It's not sort of, it's Love Wins 51-49. But in the real world, that feels sometimes as good as it's going to get.
Wow. Beautifully put. Wow. Love Wins 51-49. Wow.
And so I want to, this whole project is been developed in order to share that moment of joy, of bittersweet wonder with, yeah, of love.
Yes.
That's why this exists. And I hope we achieve that. I watched a run the other day and I'm thinking we're getting there.
We're getting there. And this is several years in the making.
Yeah. Researched it in, it was very funny, in 2018 or 19. All roads about FTD lead to Dr. Bruce Miller. He's just, he's the one who really, the neurologist who really put this on the map. And he's sort of like the Jim Henson of neurology, I think. He's a genius. And very zen. And so I researched and researched and I got as far as I could. And then I wrote him a fan letter. And I said, hey, I'm really interested in this. I'd love to chat with you about it. Could you, would you talk to me about it? And he was like, oh, are you Jake from Silicon Valley? And I was like, yeah. And then we started up this conversation. He sent me a book that was like about this, like 4 inches thick. I think it was like neurocircuitry genomics. And it was just beyond. So I took 6 months with a highlighter and read like the chapters that were relevant. And then I came back to him with more questions. And he was like, well, why don't you come up and be the Hellman visiting artist and spend some time with us here at UCSF, which I think is like the second biggest neurology department in the country. And they are just, the Memory and Aging Center is and the Global Brain Health Institute, which is up there, are just, it's a palace. It's a palace of inquiry and curiosity and learning. And they care so much. And it's just beautiful. And so that's the play came out of that that experience in 2019, and then the pandemic happened, and so we couldn't do it live, so we had to do it online, and there's an online version of it, which we did, and that won some awards and did really well. And then, but it was always intended to be live. And then we, then these extraordinary, this team of people, Kath Britton, this amazing producer, and James Bonus, this wonderful director, and this composer, Mark Gray, have come on board. And we've been working on this for about two and a half years now. And yeah, it's just an extraordinary group of people.
What do you hope theater goers will take away from Unravel?
I hope they come away from this experience with a sense of wonder. And I hope they come away with a sense that that the brain is an incredibly powerful instrument that we have just scratched the surface of. And that there's more, we're capable of more than we ever thought. And I hope people come away from this with their hearts open.
Hearts and brains should meet together.
Ideally.
To create love. How can a listener get tickets to the play, which also includes access to the Brain Health Festival?
Oh, yeah. The Brain Health Festival is free. Also, we're I don't think I'm promoting anything if I say we're giving away these books. On the first night, we're giving, there's this book called Mysteries of the Social Brain by Dr. Bruce Miller and Dr. Virginia Sturm. And it's like an Oliver Sacks book, but it's more, it's like all of his cases, but it's done through a social lens. So you start to see that, like, there is the social patterning of humanity is reflected in the architecture of the mind. And he really draws that out in a really beautiful kind of way. We're giving that away the first night. The second night, we're giving away Emma's book, The Unexpected Journey. And then on the third night, we're actually publishing Ann Adams's book that she created called The ABC of Invertebrates, which is the most beautiful example of creative caregiving I've ever seen, because she is nonverbal and she creates these 26 paintings of invertebrates that she saw through her microscope. It's an alphabet. And her husband, Robert, writes these poems that go along with A is for anemone, B is for bumblebee, C is for crab. And they go along. And so there's this beautiful children's ABC book, words by Robert Adams, pictures by Ann Adams. And it's just glorious. And so we're publishing it and giving that away to the audience on the third night. And, like, as you say, without being preachy, this is just a book that's a, this is good for snuggling. And we make sure it's, you know, we have the pages, the poems printed both on the left, right way, and then because the pictures are radial symmetry, they're circles, and then you have the upside down on the right side, so that you can, it's for, it's designed for bidirectional snuggling. So if you read this book with somebody this way, that's fine, but then if you need to flip over that side, you can read it with them that way too.
Bidirectional.
Very important.
Listen, Jake Broder, this has really been an illuminating evening and a lot of information. People can see the play called Unraveled at the Wallace in Beverly Hills, October 17th, 18th, and 19th. We have to make way for Pat with Alien Air in about 1.5 minutes. This is the Mystic Pete Chronicles. I'm available on mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. Christine, you are available at
CA90048.
There we go. And yeah. Where can people get more information?
Unraveledplay.com.
Well, this has been an extraordinary show, really. And we are trying to solve some major challenges that face humanity. And this involves science and medicine and doctors. And I know there's, you know, a lot of conspiracy theories and suspicions these days about all this stuff, but we have to embrace this, like, main pinnacle of human knowledge, because this is the way forward for a lot of conditions, that it's the only way forward. So thank you for opening the door to accessibility of understanding all this through the arts. Thank you so much for your time, and let's do another show. I hope people can check out this play, right?
Yeah, please come down. We'd love to have you.
Jake, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Mystic Beat Corner.
You're listening to KXLU at LMU, 88.9 FM, Los Angeles.